this is the beginning of a fascist regime, and I think that people will not realize until it's too late.
Next on Carolina Connection, protesters at UNC vow to fight back against the Trump administration's efforts to deport two pro-Palestinian students from Columbia University. I'm Maddie Policastro.
And I'm Sarah Ellis. Also this week, Town of Chapel Hill unpublished web pages concerning LGBTQ history, minority loan programs, and more. Egg prices are down from their record highs, but Triangle businesses and consumers are still feeling the effects. And North Carolina elementary and middle school test scores have still not recovered from the pandemic.
For them, school was a screen, and all of a sudden school is a classroom with other children around. That was a brand new experience.
From the UNC Hussman School of Journalism and Media, this is Carolina Connection.
Thank you for joining us. Almost a year after pro-Palestinian protests erupted at American college campuses, the Trump administration is cracking down on some international students who participated. Columbia University student Mahmoud Khalil, a native of Syria who is a permanent U.S. resident, appeared in immigration court Friday. A judge scheduled a hearing for April 11th on whether Khalil can stay in the United States. Khalil faces deportation after he helped lead Columbia's pro-Palestinian demonstrations in 2024. Meanwhile at UNC, protesters congregated on the Quad Wednesday to criticize what they say are unconstitutional actions by the Trump administration. Regan Rimes reports.
Free Cordelia, free Khalil!
Free Cordelia, free Khalil!
Free all political prisoners!
Free all political prisoners!
About 100 protesters led chants, held signs, and locked arms on the Quad. In masks and keffiyehs, the group protested against the detainment of Columbia University students Lakia Cordia and Mahmoud Khalil. Cordia is from the West Bank and is in the U.S. on an expired student visa. Khalil, a 30-year-old Syrian native, has a green card, but the Trump administration is looking to revoke it. At the protest, a speaker read part of Khalil's letter from prison.
The Trump administration is targeting me as part of a broader strategy to suppress dissent. Visa holders, green card carriers, and citizens alike will be the target of their political beliefs. All of us.
The Trump administration released a statement saying, in its words, any foreign nationals visiting our country are prohibited from supporting any designated terrorist organization, like Hamas. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says students who do that should expect consequences.
If you told us all these things when you applied for a visa, we would deny your visa. I hope we would. If you actually end up doing that, once you're in this country on such a visa, we will revoke it. And if you end up having a green card, not citizenship, but a green card as a result of that visa while you're here in those activities, we're going to kick you out.
Wednesday's protest hosted several speakers, including UNC faculty members. Demonstrators wanted to prevent anyone from being deported, detained, or having their status reconsidered due to protest activities. UNC Chancellor Lee Roberts has said the university must comply with ICE. Associate Professor in the Communication Department Michael Palm says people can't rely on the UNC administration to advocate for free speech protections, but others will.
I just think it's important that students here who are at risk, and faculty and staff for that matter, who are at risk and who are scared, know that there are faculty as well as students here who are willing to support them, willing to defend them, willing to fight for them.
Palestinian-Jordanian international graduate student Hashim Amideh says everyone's free speech rights are at risk, and it's imperative to speak out.
I mean, I think it's empowering and it's cathartic. But it's also sometimes disappointing because I think there is actually a lot of support if you ask students on campus for Palestine. I think people are mortified by what Israel's doing. But I think there's a lot of apathy and people wanting to go about their business. And I find that a bit disappointing. People are unwilling to acknowledge that this is the beginning of a fascist regime. And I think I worry that people will not realize until it's too late.
Amireh says he knows students' rights are at risk, but he's willing to push back.
I'm here to show that we are not scared no matter how much the Trump administration tries to repress us and tries to intimidate us. We will fight back no matter the cost.
Friday, an immigration judge scheduled Columbia student Khalil's hearing for April 8th. The Trump administration plans to invoke the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act, which says the government can deport those having potentially serious adverse foreign policy consequences for the United States. In Chapel Hill, I'm Regan Rimes. Now we're joined by Kevin Goldberg, the vice president of the Freedom Forum and a First Amendment expert, to discuss the legal implications of this case. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
We just heard that the Trump administration plans to invoke the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act. How does this act apply to a case like this?
Well, the Immigration and Nationality Act does give broad powers to the executive branch to allow non-citizens into the United States and even to remove non-citizens from the United States. However, they are limited in the way they go about this in two ways, really. One, a non-First Amendment way, which is all these people have to be afforded due process before they're removed from the United States. And two, they still, we think, have First Amendment rights and can't be removed from the United States simply for what they say. That second part is a little more in question. I think that's where a lot of the questions and controversy and things we're going to have to see play out are going to come into play.
Yeah, I'm curious, has this act been used in similar cases before? And what did that precedent look like, if so?
Well, there's no single on-case precedent that talks about this. What we do know, and what is clear, is that the First Amendment does not talk about people. When we're looking specifically on whether the Immigration and Nationality Act allows for someone to be removed based on what they have said or views they have expressed, we know that the First Amendment protects people regardless of their status in the United States, because the First Amendment applies to actions of government, restricts actions of government. So it doesn't say these people have these rights. It says the government cannot infringe these rights. We also know there's a clear dividing line at the border, and that views that have been expressed while you are outside the United States can be used to prevent you from entering the United States, and even in terms of preventing you from changing your legal status, perhaps going from non-immigrant to immigrant or even to citizen. We know that much. It's the rest that is in question, because there's very little Supreme Court precedent on that issue.
And I know that there's some fear going around on campus with other student protesters about other actions that could be taken against them. Should other student protesters be worried about facing similar consequences right now?
Well, I think the political climate would unfortunately have me thinking, if I were a non-citizen and I'm in the United States, even if I'm in the United States legally, and certainly if I'm a student here on a student visa, would have me unfortunately chilled as to whether I want to speak or not. I would again say that I think these people do have First Amendment rights, and I do think they should not be chilled in this regard. No one should be chilled from expressing their First Amendment rights while they're in this country. But the simple fact is there are now measures being taken, efforts being taken to restrict those rights. And, you know, that's just a fact. Whether it's going to hold up as a legal certainty, I don't know. What we do know is we've seen people who are now being put into detention and slated for removal. And, you know, that is something that I think would worry me if I were a student. And that's very unfortunate for the state of free speech in this country right now.
Are there any other laws or legislation that have been previously used to go after protesters, especially student protesters?
Well, certainly general laws like disorderly conduct, like breach of the peace, like trespass, are used against all protesters, not just student protesters. But again, these laws of general applicability all must comply in their application with the First Amendment. So, yeah, I mean, someone could argue that you've breached the peace in participating in a protest, but if you've done nothing actually illegal and all you've done is use your words, you as an individual, and maybe the protest got out of hand and you just happened to be there, then you're going to be protected. So those are some examples of, most common examples, frankly, of state laws that are used. Now, on the other side of that, if you actually do trespass, you actually do commit acts of vandalism, the First Amendment is not going to protect you because you're no longer engaged in speech and expression, you're engaged in illegal action. And I think that's a lot of what the administration is doing, perhaps, when they talk about illegal protests. They either view all protests that they don't like as illegal, but more likely are saying that anybody who participates in a protest where illegal activities is going to have, you know, is going to be considered as having participated in illegal protests themselves, even if they did not commit any illegal acts.
Thank you so much for providing that context, and thank you so much for your time today.
It was really great talking about this, and I hope you all continue to explore these First Amendment issues.
It was 5 years ago this month that schools closed for spring break and didn't reopen because of COVID-19. The pandemic has still left many elementary and middle school students struggling with basic reading comprehension and math concepts. Melody Carty spoke to educators in the Chapel Hill Carrboro City School District to learn more about what is being done to help students.
I want to help you, but you be, yeah, you already finished because you're smart.
Every Monday and Wednesday evening, the Hargraves Community Center in Chapel Hill hosts a tutoring program where volunteers work with students on homework assignments. The person overseeing the tutoring, Brenton Harrison, says he remembers the importance of helping students right after the pandemic.
All the kids that came into that program, low test scores, low grades, and by the time they all left that semester, they were on the AB Honor Roll.
According to data published at the beginning of this year by the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction, test scores for elementary and middle school students are still lower than they were before the pandemic. Noah Stuchner, Director of Elementary Math and Science for Chapel Hill Carrboro Schools, says students have had a difficult time adjusting to in-person learning.
Kids who didn't have experience with what was school before, for them, school was a screen, and all of a sudden school is a classroom with other children around. That was a brand new experience.
The change has also greatly impacted teachers. During the pandemic, lesson plans for math followed a three-step structure. Teachers would show an example and then walk students through a practice problem. Students were then tasked with attempting practice problems on their own time.
Teacher loved those slides and presentations, and they wanted to continue in math class because it's easier as a teacher.
Stuchner says her goal since coming back has been to re-implement more tactile approaches, a model she says is fundamental to teaching students math.
We came back from the pandemic and manipulatives are in the closet, and I'm still struggling bringing it back to the tables.
Tammy Eddins, Director of Elementary Humanities, says reading and comprehension were also a challenge to teach virtually. Teachers were unable to give students the one-on-one time they needed to learn.
We want students to have goal setting around reading. That multi-sensory piece really, really suffered.
Without school libraries, students could not choose their own books. Eddins says this discouraged many children from reading altogether.
We want students to have access to varied genres and topics. I'm personally passionate about students seeing themselves in the books that they read. All of those things are important.
Earlier this year, State Superintendent Mo Green shared the NCDPI and State Board of Education's joint legislative priorities. These include several initiatives like professional development courses for teachers, small group tutoring programs, and new technology for students. But Eddins says the issue is deeper than just meeting testing benchmarks.
I like to think about our test scores kind of as an iceberg. There's more to the story. We need proficiency, don't get me wrong, but we need more than that. We need to really, really educate the whole child.
You done with your homework? You sure? Is it correct?
While the NCDPI works on initiatives to improve test scores, Harrison says tutoring programs like the one at Hargraves remain essential to helping students where the district can't.
We know that it's impactful in several different ways, you know, building relationships, also getting their schoolwork done. So this free tutor program allows for those gaps to be filled in to really build an equitable community.
On March 17th, Superintendent Green started his Mo Wants to Know tour, a series of visits across the 8 regions of North Carolina for listening and learning sessions. At the end of the tour, the NCDPI will gather the data and draft a strategic plan of goals and initiatives for North Carolina schools. All parents, students, educators, and community members are invited to attend. From Chapel Hill, this is Melody Carty.
The town of Chapel Hill has restored pages related to DEI to the town's website after community backlash. Triangle Blog Blog reported Wednesday that the webpages had been removed, and some residents are still upset, though the town says it removed the pages for routine website maintenance. I'm joined by Carolina Connections' Lily Kane. So Lily, what have you learned about the content of the missing pages?
Yeah, so town staff quietly removed 17 different pages from the town's website. Some of those pages were related to DEI, with topics like resources for LGBTQ employees, the town's DEI resolutions and ordinances, loans for lower-income business owners, LGBTQ history, and racial equity. Town staff also removed some pages not related to these topics, like pages that linked to town committees that no longer exist. The town restored all 17 pages Wednesday after a public outcry on social media and in emails to the town council.
And the town initially explained that it had removed those web pages for routine maintenance as staff created a new website, and that the pages had low view counts.
Yes, that's according to information from the town manager, but I also spoke to town council member Theodore Nollert. He said staff may have also removed the pages out of fear of facing scrutiny from the federal government.
A few weeks ago, when the federal government started to go haywire with executive orders slashing funding, a lot of illegal activity, the first concern for the town was, look, we have critical functions that are funded by federal dollars. Step one is, how do we continue to provide the same services, but not paint a bright red target on ourselves and say, take our money now?
Lily, the town of Chapel Hill receives a lot of federal funding, but what is that federal funding going towards?
A lot of that funding is related to public transportation. Nollert said Chapel Hill Transit receives about $2.5 million in annual operating expenditures, and that money supports about 750,000 rides each year. The town of Chapel Hill is also waiting to hear whether they will receive tens of millions of dollars from the federal government to support their Bus Rapid Transit project. And then outside of transportation, Chapel Hill also uses federal grants to provide affordable housing.
So what does this mean for the town going forward?
So in emails to the town council, some residents said they're still angry even though the town has restored the web pages. One resident wrote that they felt horror and disbelief at the news. Another said that they were sad about the removal and they were worried that it had damaged the town's standing with marginalized groups in the community. Nollert said the town is going to have to continue to work to rebuild trust with these residents. And he also said the town is still trying to figure out how to navigate this changing landscape with federal funding.
We're going to need creativity as we think about, okay, we perform certain essential functions that are tied to getting money from entities who don't share our values. We are not willing to give away everything, and we're not willing to give away anything ahead of time.
Mayor Jess Anderson also told me in an email that the town council plans to establish more lines of communication with town staff to avoid incidents like this one.
Well, Carolina Connections, Lily Kane, thank you.
You're listening to Carolina Connection, the weekly student radio program at UNC Hussman School of Journalism and Media. I'm Maddie Policastro.
And I'm Sarah Ellis. While egg prices have finally fallen from their peak, many consumers and businesses have flocked to other ways to get their eggs, such as local farms. Maya Hagen explores the feathered phenomenon.
Due to the nationwide rise in the cost of eggs, we've added a temporary 50-cent per egg surcharge, a Durham Waffle House menu sticker reads. Because of the bird flu outbreak causing supply shortages, the restaurant decided to start charging extra for menu items with eggs. Here at the Waffle House, Chef Corey Strickland says he understands why.
I mean, I was a little taken aback when I first heard the news. Like, really? It's that bad around here? But it seems reasonable, but I don't know, I wouldn't pay for it personally, but that's what seems like the natural next step for them would be once they heard about those prices increasing.
Here at Walmart Supercenter in Durham, UNC student Sabrina Honeycutt says she's had to find creative solutions.
My roommate, we go back home, we live in the Outer Banks, and her family has a farm where they have eggs and duck eggs. So we've actually resulted to like going back home, like to our home counties, and like bringing our eggs back.
But while some farms are having to spend more on production due to bird flu outbreaks, here at Valley Love Farm and Seven Falls Farm in Fuquay Varina, farmers Jonathan Daniel and Damon Rondo are finding themselves unaffected by the crisis.
Our chickens are out in the open air. There's nothing at all that is actually affecting our chickens. And they always tell me, Jonathan, if you get one chicken sick, all of them are gonna die. And I've been doing it since 2007. I've never had even a single chicken sick.
Daniel and Rondo say this has allowed them to maintain their prices despite the outbreak, which for Daniel is between $8 and $11, depending on the size of the egg, providing consistency for their loyal customers in an uncertain market. However, Daniel's customers used to ask him why he was more expensive than his competitors.
I'll say, take that dozen of eggs. I want you to go cook that dozen eggs comparable to the store eggs and see the difference. And so how am I supposed to cook it? I said, don't put anything. And they'll come to me and they'll say, wow, what did you put in those chickens? I said, it's what I didn't put in that chicken.
And for farms like Valley Love and Seven Falls, the growing interest in locally sourced eggs has had unexpected benefits.
It gives us more customers coming to see what we have is eggs because there's an egg shortage. And so we introduce them to a whole new level of quality in an egg.
According to the USDA, while prices remain high due to ongoing supply disruptions, production is beginning to stabilize, with some regions seeing a gradual decline in prices. In Fuquay Varina, I'm Maya Hagen.
Finally, what started as a hobby for one Raleigh resident has now led to an effort by local organizations and the city to clean up litter using trash traps. Andy Zhao was on the ground for the ribbon-cutting ceremony for the traps and has more.
Are we not cutting it up here?
Oh, sorry, you are going to cut it.
A group of representatives from Sound Rivers, the Great Raleigh Cleanup, and the City of Raleigh gathered next to Marsh Creek to celebrate the installation of a new trash trap. Trash traps are made up of floating buoys and chain-link fences. They are passive litter-catching devices on urban waterways, sitting on top of creeks and collecting litter flowing downstream without disturbing the surrounding environment. The partnership between the city and the two organizations has 10 trash traps in the nearby Neuse and Tarpamlica watershed. Volunteer coordinator Emily Fritz says that trash traps are great for multiple reasons.
Once we installed our first and second one, it was a great example of that they are really effective at removing litter. They're great for building more community and getting more folks involved with the issues in their area.
The installation of trash traps in Raleigh has been a gradual evolution. 3 years ago, after being awarded a grant and purchasing a trash trap, Sound Rivers approached the Great Raleigh Cleanup and the city to create a partnership. The Great Raleigh Cleanup helps with maintaining and monitoring the traps, while the city helps with planning and finding new locations for them to be installed in the Raleigh area. Although the trash traps have been great at combating littering, Raleigh Senior Water Quality Specialist Joyce Gaffney says that they aren't perfect.
The sides are like chain link fence, so if you have something very, very small, it will flow through, but they do an excellent job of removing bottles and styrofoam and other larger items from our creeks.
Preston Ross III is waiting in the creek, picking up a plastic bottle caught in the trash trap. Ross founded the Great Raleigh Cleanup in 2020 as a hobby, but he had no idea what it would become.
I didn't think it was going to be anything more than that. It was just kind of like I always tell people it was just something to do. And it blossomed into so much more than just a hobby. Like I said, it became a business, a nonprofit, my career. Kind of, you know, it sounds cheesy, but like my legacy or whatnot.
Ross says that it takes a lot of effort to not only install new trash traps, but also to maintain current ones. But for him, the work is all worth it.
I think the most rewarding portion of what I get to do is the building of community, because we're going to be picking up litter for the foreseeable future. But while we're doing it, we're building community and making friendship and partnerships.
Looking forward, Ross says that he wants the partnership to do more.
In our volunteer cleanup, let's do more volunteer cleanups. In our workforce program, which employs unhoused individuals in Raleigh, let's employ more unhoused individuals. Our Adopt the Block program, which supplies residents with the tools they need to pick up litter, let's supply more residents.
Although littering hasn't necessarily decreased in recent years, Sound Rivers, the Great Raleigh Cleanup, and the City of Raleigh are optimistic about raising awareness and getting more volunteers to help.
Oh, look at that. Yeah, I got
you. In Raleigh, I'm Andy Zhao.
From all of us here in the studio, and from all of our reporters, we appreciate you tuning into the program and supporting student journalism. You've been listening to Carolina Connection, a production of the UNC Hussman School of Journalism and Media. Our technical directors are Kalius Galbraith-DeCanto and Kevin Paris. I'm Sarah Ellis.
And I'm Maddie Policastro. If you like what you heard, there's more to be discovered at carolinaconnection.org. You can also find our stories on Instagram, Facebook, Blue Sky, or wherever you get your podcasts. Now back to weekend programming on 97.9 The Hill.